Oh, nice. Keep the Brother Hyatt here. Where does the word paradox come from? What does it mean? It's a paradox. We use the word a lot.
Paradox can be a
right. I know you're obviously thinking because it has a double meaning, actually. No, para means by the side, offside, off course, on the side. It's always para, you see. Like paramilitary or paramedics. They're not all the way medics, they're not all the way military. They're para, you see. And doxa is appearance, or doxa means, well, appearance is the word. Doxa is a Greek word. It's one of the few with a short A ending. Doxa is appearance. So paradoxa, a thing that is not as it appears, not exactly as it appears. You'd expect it to be, or according to rule, well, doxa is connected with dogma the same way, but doxa is appearance or expectation. Doxa, expectation, is a good word for it. So it's not exactly what you think it would be. There's something wrong here. So when Moroni, how was the smartest man of all the Nephites, writes the silliest letter of all the Nephites, an idiotic letter, he's bound to defeat his purpose in writing it. That is a paradox. But it can be explained, namely by the letter that the Moron writes back to him. He writes back the same sort of thing. Here he enters it, and after being so tactful, and Amaran's no less, they don't both want a deal. It's very much in the interest of each one to exchange prisoners. Moroni needs them badly, and Amoron is tired of feeding a lot of Nephite women and children, which they conquered in the cities. It's not getting them anywhere. So they want to exchange, both of them, but the deal falls through completely when Amoron replies in the same terms. Amoron, when he received the epistle, he was angry too. Remember, Moroni said, I am in my anger. So they engage in this stichomathia. We were talking about that the next time. Now, this gives the case of the Lamanites. See, they have a case too, supposedly. Yes. Ye have murdered. I am the brother of Amalickiah whom ye have murdered. Behold, I will avenge his blood on you. Yea, I will come upon you with my armies. I fear not your threatenings. Well, that's exactly what Moroni said to him. We're not afraid of your threatenings. I'll come upon you with my armies and you'll become extinct. It's like that. Behold, your fathers did wrong their brethren, insomuch that they did rob them of the right to govern. So we was robbed. See, Laman and Lemuel were robbed because they were the older brothers. But he makes a reasonable suggestion, just exactly as Moroni does. If you'll do what I want you to, then we can settle this very nicely. As he says, but if you lay down your arms and subject yourself to be governed by those to whom the government doth rightly belong, then I will cause my people that they shall lay down their weapons, and they shall war no more. Now, well, that's a nice way to end the war. Just give us that. Well, that's exactly the proposition that Moroni put forth. Then he goes on. We're in the 54th chapter, as you know here. Ye have breathed out many threatenings against me, and he did, you see. We fear not your threatenings. Well, routine, you see. Well, this is just routine. Each one, this is the sort of thing you'd expect. I will grant the exchange of prisoners gladly, you see. But if you won't agree to our terms, we will wage a war which shall be eternal. That's the policy of the Muslims, to wage an eternal war until you've submitted, till all the world has submitted. Islam means submission, of course. And until the world has submitted, then it's Dar al-Harb. They're in a state of rebellion and must be subdued. So the war never stops. Until on, that's the Roman doctrine of Ager Hosticus and Ager Pacatus, the Roman Empire, the Empire of Peace, Pax Romana. Everybody's settled down. The world has to be that way, or they can't trust anybody else. It's dangerous to have people out there who are not taking orders from you. You've got to, that's what imperialism is, you see. The impar, the one, the unequal one, the one who dominates the whole thing. When people are par, they're divided into equal sides. But when they're impar, the imperator is the one who's impar. That's at least Max Radin's theory, at any rate. Well, we will wage a war which shall be eternal. And God, whom you say we have rejected, we know not such a being as far as that goes. But if it so be that there is a devil and a hell, behold, we will send you, that we will not send you there to dwell with my brother, whom ye have murdered, whom ye have hinted, hath gone to such a place, but behold, these things matter not. I am a Moron, descendant of Zoram, whom your fathers pressed and brought out of Jerusalem. Now he gets heated up, remember? toward the end of his letter, Alma said, Alma Moroni said, I am in my anger. And he says here, behold, I am a bold Lamanite. War has been raised to avenge their wrongs and to maintain their rights of government. So the Lamanites really thought they had a case. You always do in the war. He presents his case here. And he ends up there. And they were angry. Well, now we say, this is a paradox. They should write such. But this is really a formality. We haven't talked about the language of the Book of Mormon, but it's formulaic. You notice it follows in formula. They used to make fun of the many times it came to pass as repeated. Well, in Egyptian, you have to begin to sense. There's some writings like the story of the two brothers or the story of the foredoomed prince, in which every sentence begins with the formula, it came to pass, you see. It came to pass after many days, and it came to pass after Herokin. It came to pass after many days, it came to pass. Every sentence begins that way. And it was required. In Arabic, for example, in classical Arabic, you can't begin a sentence cold and just say he went to town. You can't sue that. You have to say, behold, he went to town. Innahu, ila Medina. Innahu, well, dhaba ila Medina. Verily he went to. Or you have to begin with the and he went and something. But you just don't begin a sentence that way. You have to begin with a soften people up. With usually inna, that's the commonest word. Behold, in Hebrew, of course, why-yahi, came to pass. Why-yahi, fa-inna. But you must put inna at the beginning of the sentence if you're going to begin with a noun. You can't say, the man was rich, rajul ghani. You have to say, inna, right, behold, the man was rich. Or rajul hubahi, the man, he was the one who was rich. And so it goes. They have these formalities which you must follow. Well, now the whole ancient life, the whole ancient world, medieval world, modern world, is bound up in these, not just customs, but their rules, strict rules, rigid forms, formalities. We thought we'd broken away from that, didn't we? See, with the Industrial Revolution, and with Darwin, and with modern science, we weren't bound by old forms and strict rules and strange dress and customs that required us to do things in certain stiff and predictable ways and so forth, which bound ancient society. And this was John Dewey's doctrine. We'd broken away from all of that. We were free from all that, the superstitions and the prejudices and the narrow prescriptions of past societies. Well, of course, it couldn't have been more wrong because we walked in even more of them now. Remember White's book on the organization man, the successful man in business. You have to wear dress for success, wear the right tie, belong to the right family, go to the right church in many, many corporations, have to marry the right people. They won't let you unless you do that. As I say, you have to dress for success. You follow a form. You're in a uniform all the time, and you think. You have to think the same way. You have to use the same jargon as is used by the others, the same slang that's current at the time. It's very rigid, very demanding. You get out in a hurry and so forth there. And so we thought we'd escape from that, and we've become more formalistic than ever. But, of course, the most formal of all has to be the military, and we see that's why that's so. Incidentally, this Moroni writing to Amoron. Why so many words in Book of Mormon with more in them, you see? Well, of course, that's the favorite Egyptian word for there's between Ammon and Mori. The most recently found really valuable papyrus is the story of an Egyptian general by the name of Morire, and he did some wonderful things. But and it has some supernatural elements in it, too. But this is a very, very common, I mean, the Egyptians use all of it, but because it means beloved. It means good, it means everything nice, desirable, Morire, and so you say Morianton, or Moriamon means beloved of Ammon, things like that. And so Moroni, Morire, that's the Vandier papyrus, published in 1985, quite recent. A very interesting story about this general who lived back in very early times. Well, so this military behavior is the most really rigidly formalized of all. Notice the Book of Mormon, everything is so formal, but I say we are just as formal to do these things. For one thing, it's a great saving of effort, isn't it? It's a great advantage to have things formal, to have the grooves already marked, to stay in the grooves, but there's a danger to that, you see. Now, the military is a good example there. Again, we have it here, especially in the case of the 2,000 young men, the 2,000 sons of Helaman. Military behavior is the most rigid, the most formalized, and the most traditional, and it must be, and it is here. And remember, we have this in the Book of Mormon before. Moroni would invite, when he's besieging a city, he invites the people to come out. Here they're comfortably ensconced inside the city, fortified, and he invites them to come out and fight in the open field. Well, it'd be idiots to do so. But by the rules of war, he's required to do that, and he does it, and sometimes they would do anything as silly as that. And then again, he would they would make their agreements on the field. They would agree, as in the Battle of Cumorah, for example. The chiefs of the other sides agree on the time and the place of the battle, just like that. But why aren't you a smart general and catch the other fellow off guard? Catch him offside when he's not expecting you. That's the best thing to do, surprise. But that's plain naughty. You don't do that. The prisoners objected very, very strenuously at first, because we wore the first people to wear these camouflage suits. All the camouflage suits, the jumpsuits, and so forth, and we scattered out of the place. There was no unity when you scatter all over the place in landing, and so shooting from behind trees and things like that. We didn't have formal trenches, weren't formally organized. Well, they say that isn't fair. You can't do that. That's devilish, and they call them devils. They say this is wicked. This is immoral. You're not bound by the Geneva Convention, so it's very dangerous to get picked up. They didn't like that. They said you're breaking the rules. But as we say before, if you're going to start fighting, forget about rules. The only thing to do is to win in that case. But the thing is, but it has to be. These unbreakable rules, these traditions, this iron discipline, because nothing is more dangerous, an unpredictable animal, than an armed band. You give men a lot of weapons, and everyone has the curse of Nimrod on him. It's up to him to decide who shall live and who shall die, and only God can decide that. But if you give me a gun, I can decide who will live and who will die. What power that gives me, you see? Nimrod had that power, which, of course, is given God. God gives it to no man. We've seen that before. Forbidden to shed blood. So we have this... Iron discipline is necessary. You know, soldiers are necessary hot-headed. That's what they get paid for, as far as that. Remember Shakespeare's soldier, full of strange oaths and bearded like the pard, because he's a mercenary, you see. In Shakespeare's day, everybody's a mercenary. And bearded like the pard, he says, jealous of honor and quick in quarrel, seeking the bubble reputation even at the cannon's mouth, impetuous, fierce. And of course there's a lot written about the swaggering, the braggadocio of the soldier. The earliest Roman comedy we have is Miles Gloriosus, the Plautus. The typical, he's a Roman soldier, but he swaggers around, and he's a dangerous person because he has to show off all the time, and really he's quite a coward, just like Falstaff. See, Falstaff is the immortal soldier of fortune who goes around on either side, as far as that goes. Prince Eugene, the greatest general of the 18th century, fought on either side, made no difference to him. So in this case, you have to have this absolutely iron, rigid discipline. You didn't need it with the 2,000 sons. That's an interesting thing, you see, these agreements on the field, this formality. But not only are armies unpredictable, but remember what Clausewitz said. Of all human activities, none is so completely under the control of pure chance as war. Pure chance. There's nobody can decide in the end. And that being the case, you see, if it's so rigidly under pure chance, what are we to do about it in this case? There's this uncertainty. Well, one rule is, whoever goes to war doesn't know what he's doing. That's literally true. If you go to war, you don't know what you're doing, because war, more than anything else, is under the domain of chance, pure chance. You never can tell how it's going to turn out. Whoever figured it out right how it was going to turn out. These awful things. They thought the war would end at Bull Run. They thought it would end at Charleston and so forth. And it went on for nearly 5 years. Terrible things, the Civil War. Always just predicting when it would end. Well, and so it is here. But we have, most armies are very hard to regulate, and so they break down. And as soon as looting begins, no army has any control at all. Pilleville is a good example, Pilleville in Paris, of that, but we won't go into that. But see, you can't keep soldiers from looting, and they don't pretend to. They will always pick up something. In the British Army, it's a scream, though. They have no discipline. In the field, you can wear anything you want, do anything you want. That's just that. Because after all, the soldier is free. He's armed. He's as much as armed as the general is. He can do his own damage, you see. You get not only the barbarian hordes and so forth, and you get, see, when the Roman Empire broke up, all of Gaul suddenly was taken over by Bagaudi. These are free raiding bands that would go around picking things up when they're the bad. This is the thing you look forward to, the Bagaudi. And later on, the terrible 14th century, which Froissart tells us all about, you have the free companies. Everywhere you had free companies organizing themselves about this person or that person, some leader, and then they'd go through the country looting and pillaging and taking what they want. Sometimes he would settle down, take a castle, and set himself up as the lord there, and many a great house was started that way, just by freebooters. And of course it was the condottieri in Italy. The same thing all through the Renaissance, all through Shakespeare's time, and so forth. So you have these three companies are early, then you get the condottieri, you get the earlier the times, the Bagadic. There are traditions, they go back to the old barbarian tribal raids and so forth, raiding each other. But it's all very unpredictable and so forth, and you have to have this iron discipline. And the worst of all was the Roman army. Well, now, to get the great Roman Empire, you had to have a real iron discipline, and they did. It was their great army that did everything, you see. But look, more than half the emperors were deposed by the soldiers and put in by the soldiers. The man who promised them the most pay got elected emperor, and they proceeded to wipe out his predecessor. This happened not once, but more than 30 times. There it begins right at the beginning, you see. You start in already, the army, after murdering Elagabalus, it's the Praetorian Guards, the most trained of all, the emperor's personal guard, they are rampage through the palace and find Claudius hiding in a closet and make him emperor. He didn't want to be emperor. And then you go down the line, they get in an intrigue with Livia, they get Nero out of the way, he wasn't doing them any good. And then came three men in a row, Galba, Otho, and Vitellius. Each one was richer than the other, and each one promised the army higher pay than the other. So Galba was rich and promised them high pay, so they put him in. But when Otho promised them more, they put him in. And Vitellius was extremely fat and extremely rich, and he promised them a lot, and they murdered his preceptor and put him in. And then this goes on. You get this, when Decius gets rid of Philippus Arabs, and when Philip himself gets rid of Gordians, and when the army gets rid of Elagabalus, and then they get rid of Antoninus Pius, who was a very good emperor, always for this same reason. There's a long list of them. And, well, so it goes on, Commodus, to get rid of some obnoxious ones too. Caracalla, they got rid of him that way. And so it goes. Well, when the most dangerous thing of all, you see, it's a dangerous thing as far as this goes, because so we have this very interesting case of the 2,000 sons. There have been such things. Incidentally speaking, I just remembered here, and just wrote it down this morning, the typical exchange of insults before the battle is literary, and it's a device, and it's a common. I mean, it is required in epic literature, but it was really done. In the Zendavesta, it's this case in the Abinyasht, where Acht, the sorcerer, comes with a huge army, and he's going to besiege the city of the wise men, and he says, "I'll lay it flat unless you can answer 33 riddles." The idea. And so he puts the riddles to them, and the wise men answer the 33 riddles, and then they give him three riddles if he can't answer. And he can't answer them, so he's flattened himself, because he's flattened by what they call the what is this thing? The nirang. It's called the nirang, which means a situation that's too much for you to handle. So he loses out. But this is the common thing, and the classic case of this is Queen Bilkis and King Solomon, the Queen of Sheba. There's a vast corpus of legends. And the best source for this is our good old pal Thalaby, whom we quoted before, you know. He tells how when the Queen of Sheba, the Queen of the North, the South rather, marched against Solomon with a huge army, Solomon said, "Well, here, we're going to make a settlement." So they exchange riddles. First of all, he sends his jinns. He says, "Well, here comes the Queen of Sheba. I'm going to convert her to Islam. So you better go into the ground to her palace and steal her throne." She's on the march now, her camp, and steal her throne and bring it here. Steal all the things you can, rob her blind before she becomes a Muslim, because after she becomes a Muslim, she'll be sacred, and of course I can't touch her stuff. We have the same thing. We believe the Ten Commandments apply only to the good guys, the people we like. They don't apply to the people we don't like. You see, thou shalt not murder, thou shalt not lie. Well, if you don't like the person, that's different. But, and that's what King Solomon did. He wanted to plunder Sheba. When she came up, she had some riddles for him, and he had some riddles for her. So they exchanged riddles, and she won. She made a monkey of him. And the same story is told, well, that's the Shulamite in the Old Testament. This is the tradition. It happened, the story of Croesus and Tamaris. Cyrus was the great king, the conqueror of the world, you see. Cyrus, there was one nation he hadn't conquered. That was the Massagetae far in the north. And she was under Queen Tamaris. Queen Tamara said that, so he went up, he had to be the last one. She asks him not to do it. She says, it'll be foolish, you'll destroy yourself if you do this. Vanity, God doesn't mean that one man shall rule all the earth. So she invites him to a banquet. Well, he had tricked and murdered her son. Well, it was in battle anyway. But at the banquet, they exchanged riddles. She won, cut off his head, put his head in a bag full of blood and shook it around and said, you wanted to drink blood, now have all the blood you want. The story of Queen Tamiris, you see. But the idea is she was the riddling queen. And there are at least a dozen, I had a long article on this one, at least a dozen queens by the name of Tamiris that do the very same thing. So this is a set, a formal sort of thing. The exchange of riddles before the... Well, and then the story of the Green Knight, you know, Sir Gawain and the Green Knight, you go to the underworld, you have to answer certain riddles. In other words, they put the riddle in the place of the battle. The reason they do this, you see, is the stichomathia is the basic idea to absolve the ones for the crime and the plunder you're about to commit, you see. That is, this deadly rivalry, you work yourself up into a lather, you justify what you're about to do, you exaggerate the evil intent of your enemy and the necessity of your destroying him. Destroy them or they will destroy you. That's it, you see, and this is at the end. This is what Ammon talks about. Remember when he went out to preach to the Nephites, he said, to the Lamanites, he says, well, you're crazy. The only way to deal with those people is to destroy them or they destroy you. But Ammon wouldn't have any of that. But this is the idea. You have to do this to work yourself up. On the other hand, is maybe you can avoid it. You have your misgivings. It's a very expensive thing. And since war is all chance, you may lose. So why not settle it a different way? How about a war of wits anyway? It's all a war of wits anyway. The chieftain, the smartest chieftain, usually wins the battle. It's a war of wits anyway you look at it. So why not play the game of chess? And that's why chess was invented on the steppes of Asia by the constantly raiding tribes. These are Central Asia is a land that has no natural boundaries. So everybody's always raiding everybody else and trying to determine who's infringing on who else's tribal boundaries. This is especially so in Arabia, as we see in that great work, the Beni Hilal, the Epic of the Beni Hilal. Much like Book of Mormon in these war things, very much like it. But the idea is there's no boundaries and so forth. They're always raiding each other. Well, that's very expensive because when you win, you're supposed to exterminate the other side. Well, they did that. That's Genghis Khan started out doing that, but he found that that was very wasteful. Why not have the other side just submit to him and add to his army? And that's what happened. And so he rolled up a tremendous force and was able to conquer Europe, conquer everything. He was the greatest conqueror of them all. Because of that, you see, he would let them go. So here we have these people say, well, let's play a game of chess instead. And the winner take all, and the winner does, see. The king is checkmate, he's shakmach, you see. Shakmach means he's dead. Machas in all Semitic language means dead. The shakmach means the chief is dead, so you take the army, you pick up everything. You pick up the pieces, you don't wipe them off the board. You want to keep as many on the board as you can. You want to spare as much as you can. Because, as the Book of Mormon shows us, and as Liddell Hart tells us, wars in the end go back to personal conflicts. It's a personal conflict. And if Amorin is got out of the way, if you get rid of Amalickiah, remember when Amalickiah was getting his tent, people woke up New Year's Day, war was over as far as they were concerned. Moroni let him go home. As far as that, he doesn't bind people down or exploit them or anything like that because it's a purely defensive war he's fighting, and there is such a thing. So we have King Bilkis and the rest. Now, every soldier is bound to ask questions again, and this is another thing, you see. And the main thing is that they should not ask questions. There is not to reason why. You always know the story of the 500 and so forth in the Crimean War. There's not to reason why, there's but to do and die. But there comes a point when you have to reason and ask yourself the question, is his property worth my life, you see? Is defending his property worth my life? And that question comes, remember, for 15 pennies is what you can do. I've had my 14 pennies worth today. I'll accept the 14 pennies, but I'm not going to risk my life anymore today, he says. Well, so that is Moroni's challenge to Pahoran, after all. He says to them, remember, is this going to go on? Can you sit on your thrones and stop the stupor? Surrounded by thousands who are not doing anything at all, but living it up. This was the picture at Zarahemla. He says, while we out here are suffering, you're not even supplying us with food, you're not giving us anything. This letter we're soon to read here. He says, well, that's the idea. The soldiers, in the end, kicks over the traces. He's not the government. He has no right to write this sort of thing to the heads of government. Moroni again, no. But he, of course, he'd been given great powers. But he challenges... he challenges Perron in this very idea. So, and as Clausewitz says, the common soldier is expected to make the self-sacrifice. He doesn't expect any promotion or anything like that. In the British Army, a common soldier can never be mentioned in dispatches. You have to be an officer to be mentioned. You might save the day or win the war, but you will never be mentioned in the newspapers, the dispatches, unless you're a member of the right family. It's all families. Remember Sir Miles Dempsey coming out? There's a lecture on that. Well, a good example of that is at Eindhoven, where that's the beginning of Philips Radio. It used to be the biggest radio in the world. It began at Eindhoven in Holland. Well, that's where we landed, and from the air. And here near Eindhoven was this big house in an estate with a long brick wall around it. It was a huge estate, and it was belonging to Philips. Also, Kipnis, who was the head of our three-man team, was quickly reduced to a two-man team, but Kipnis was he was related to the great Basso, Alexander Kipnis. But he could get anything. Boy, what a wheeler dealer from Chicago there. So right away, quick, we got Philip's own private car. It was the Red Devil. It's colored bright. It was hidden, the Dutch underground had hidden in a haystack. So we got it out. It was the Red Devil, brilliant red, and it had real onyx trimmings and a front wheel drive, which was fabulous in those days. Everything was custom made about it. It was the fastest thing in Europe, and we dashed all over the country in it and could get away with anything. It made a marvelous target. So they had painted a huge white star on the hood so he wouldn't be bombarded from the air. And then we went at it, but some amazing things happened. Well, the general got jealous of it and he took it over. But that thing could outrun anything. And it was made a marvelous target, as I say. I was very glad to get rid of it. But anyway, this house. Well, here, the first thing you see when you come up to the estate, the gates of the estate, is a big sign saying, off limits to all German military personnel. Of course, it's in German. Germans occupied there. And so they didn't go. Nobody touched it. The fighting went all around it, but nobody went inside there. And when we came in, we put a big sign up, off limits to all military personnel, all American, British, it was British Second Army personnel. We couldn't go in either, see. So this man lived it up inside while the war went around. And he was selling to both sides, you know. He got rich selling to both, made no difference. The English was as good a market as the Germans for him during the war. So he sits in the middle getting rich on both sides while these kids slaughter each other. I say kids because most of them we came against, many were 15 and 16 year old. For this particular area, the Germans had scraped the bottom of the barrel. And they were just little kids. It was shocking. And the average age in the paratroops was 18 at that time. They wouldn't let you go. And 20 was the limit, you see. You couldn't be more than 5'8" either, because they say tall people broke their bones easier. In those days, they had different rules. But here they were, here we were, slaughtering each other. And there was some terrible fighting around here, all around here. And the guy could sit home having tea with either an American general or a German general, made no difference. You see, this is the way it is. So the common soldier begins to ask, now, wait a minute, what am I doing this for, you see? Dangerous, you mustn't ask that, of course. So we have this situation in the Book of Mormon right now, in Pahoran here. So here he goes, Moroni was more angry. He knew that a Mormon, aha, you see, after all, what would you expect? Both getting up on this, notice it's a personal thing. He was mad at a Mormon, he wasn't mad at anybody else. But he knew this, the 55th chapter, the first verse here. He knew that Amora knew that he was just doing, this was just PR as far as he was concerned. He said, I will not exchange prisoners. The deal falls through. Of course, this is the point. It would have been to advantage of both of them, but because of just a personal huff on both sides, and this happens quite often. I will seek death among them until I shall sue for peace. That's the way he's feeling, you see. And Amora on his side, he said the same thing. I won't sue for peace either, the third. Each was trying to be more stubborn than the other. We'll show him, I'll show him, so everything fails when you lose your temper. But I say, by form and custom, this was required to go through this idiotic routine that it was done. But I say, our routines are just as idiotic. We do the same sort of thing. One of the servants of the king who was murdered by Amalickiah, remember Amalickiah when he wanted to marry the queen and so forth, matter of Richard III, one of those servants was in his employ, and he knew all what was going on, and he came over and told the Nephites, and the Nephites were guarded the city of Gid, and the Lamanites went to the guard over the Nephites. Well, the Nephites were guarded in the city of Gid. That's where the Nephites are kept prisoner. And this, he wants these prisoners back. How are they going to get them back? Well, use the old wine trick. They say, we've escaped from the Nephites, and we have taken their wine. And don't worry, they're not going to refuse that wine. I've seen people. See, guard troops are the most boring thing in the world, guard service. Nothing must happen if you do your duty. They can't escape. Nothing must happen. Everything is quiet. So it's just bored. It goes on day after day after day. And a chance for a little party is not to be turned down. They received him with joy. He had wine. And he does a little psychology on them. You notice in the 10th verse, but Laman said to them, let's keep our wine till we go against the Nephites to battle. Well, here they're just drooling for this wine. They're going to get it now, no matter what. They said, for we are weary, therefore let us take of the wine, and by and by we'll receive wine for our rations, which will strengthen us. We'll get plenty for the Nephites. In the British Army, before every action, they always passed around rum. You always had an opportunity to drink rum. Tastes terrible. I don't like it at all. But this was to fortify you, I suppose. You're supposed to drink rum before every operation. And it came to pass they did take of the wine freely. And soldiers on duty do get drunk. I can tell some lurid cases of that. People drunk at headquarters drunk. Well, that's one way you can face. Remember, Colonel Cole was as drunk as the Lord when he went off to take Sertogenbosch. And they were all drunken. He sent to the city of Gid and cast weapons of war into the they're drunken in their sleeping drum. When in drowsy sleep their drunken natures lie, what cannot you and I perform on the unguarded Duncan? And this is what happened. They've drugged the guards, and they've said it was especially potent wine. And while they're asleep, they cast the weapons over to people inside. They fight their way out and so on. All done in a profound silence. I'm sure it's not a Laurel and Hardy silence, but sometimes you can't keep the silence too profound. But again, this is another thing, how easy it is to spring surprises. And as I mentioned before, when you consider in the Battle of the Bulge, for weeks and weeks, the Germans built up two huge armies within 5 miles of our front lines. And this went on for weeks, right there. We could see everything. Oh, boy, we didn't want to believe it. That was all. And then, now, here you have good old Moroni, the sporting man. He plays by the rules all the way through, you see, so we can be sure that these insulting letters and so forth were by the rules, too. It was not the desire of Moroni. He did not delight in the murder or bloodshed. They could have slain them, you see. Had they awakened, behold, they were drunken, the Nephites could have slain them. But behold, this was not the desire of Moroni. And he said, for this cause, he might not bring upon him injustice. He does not want to be guilty of injustice. He would not fall upon the Lamanites and destroy them in their drunkenness. Like Clerk Saunders, to shame to slay a drunken man, you see. A perfect time to wipe them out, you see. This would solve our problem right here. He wouldn't do it because it wasn't a decent thing to do. They were drunk and asleep. You can't kill people like that. That isn't right, is it? That's Moroni. He always wants to do the right thing. And this was done in the nighttime. Well, wouldn't you know? And the Nephites without, and the prisoners were armed within. And thus they saw that they were overpowered. And when they came to, their chief captains, they all had weapons now, they brought them forth and cast their own weapons at the feet of the Nephites, pleading for mercy. And Moroni took, this is what Moroni desired. He wants to take more prisoners for exchange, see, the 27th or 24th verse. This was the desire of Moroni. He took them prisoner of war. And Nephites, they joined the army of Moroni, and this was a great strength to his army. So there were a lot of prisoners there. And he also got more prisoners for exchange. And for this cause, the Lamanites, whom he had taken prisoners, he set them to labor in strengthening the fortifications of the camp. And we say he had to excuse himself for that, since he was justified because of the pressure of the time and so forth. And keep and protect all the prisoners who he had taken. Notice the 27th verse. Came to pass that they did, notwithstanding all the intrigues of the Lamanites, they were able to keep and protect all the prisoners whom they had taken. They protected them as well as keeping them. See, and the Nephites began to be victorious. Many times the Lamanites attempted their tricks, and many times did they attempt to minister them. See, they tried the wine trick. The Nephites were onto that. You adopt very quickly, you see, when they try to pull a second time. Remember the well-known maxim, if he fools you the first time, he's a rascal. If he fools you the second time, you're the rascal. It happened. This is an old maxim, too. They could not be taken with snares, not anymore. No poison, that wouldn't do anyway. And the Lamanites had fortified the city of Morianton and made it exceedingly strong. Well, now, this is a stalemate, and you can't allow a stalemate, you see. There is one rule in the German army, and that is, the first rule for German officers is, it's better to do the worst thing possible than to do nothing. That's a surprising thing to say. But because it's so paralyzing. See, these rules I mentioned before, we have to be so rigid in the military to keep men, armed men, from going off in all directions and doing their own will and breaking up into bands and so forth, which they did repeatedly. It has to be so rigid. What do you do? In this case, the... I'm going to say it paralyzes initiative in the German army, and as you get to be an officer, you get higher and higher, you get higher and higher, not for saying no, but for saying yes. You become less daring, less original, more conforming, more willingness to say yes, sir, more willingness to lick the boots and all this sort of thing. That gets you to the top. So, as usual, the officer class were people who wouldn't act unless they had approval of somebody else. They didn't want to offend anybody. They didn't want to do anything that wasn't just according to the book and so forth. And this paralyzed the German army, their lack of initiative among the officers. And this is the thing they're always trying to beat. They're trying to be a doctrinaire preaching. They say, it is better to do the worst thing than to do nothing, but do something. But time and again, they wouldn't do it. I hadn't received orders. Nobody told them what to do. And then, on the other hand, if a soldier becomes too independent and acts on his own orders, oh, the solution to that, of course, was the Maria Theresian. As you see, let him act on his orders, but shoot him if he broke the orders, if he didn't keep the orders. And so they gave them the reiteration. So this happens. We can't have this dangerous stalemate here, and this is going on, you see. And came to pass in the 13th year of the reign of Peterman, they came an epistle stating the affairs of the people in that quarter. And he tells the story of his 2,000 sons here now. And they have another kind of discipline, whom Ammon brought down out of the land of Nephi. Though you know that these were descendants of Lamanites. These 2,000 sons were good Lamanite boys. They kept their genealogies as the ancients do, and they were descendants of Laman among the Lamanites, because we read about other descendants of Zoram, other descendants of Ishmael and so forth. And they were about to break the covenant when they saw that their parents were about to break the covenant and go to war to help the Nephites and needed their help so badly. When he saw that Helaman, notice the 8th verse, when he saw that I would not suffer them that they should break this covenant, he established his integrity. He wouldn't let his parents break their oaths. Well, they're not going to break any oaths of theirs. They weren't required to take an oath, but they took one spontaneously, and they kept it because they knew Helaman was one they could trust. Establish his own integrity. The Japanese colonel at Port Arthur had a regiment commanded by a company commanded by his son, and the company was in danger of being destroyed unless they could pass through a particular civilian area which would be brought under artillery fire. But according to the rules of war, this is in 1904, you see, according to the rules of war, civilians were sacrosanct. They couldn't be slaughtered. So he allowed his own son, knowingly allowed his own son to be killed and his company to be wiped out, rather than kill any civilians. That's inconceivable now, where we zero in on civilians. They're first. We send the Air Force over the city and wipe it out. Let them have the firebombs first of all. What a world we're living in now. We've come a long way since 1904. But this integrity, Moroni's integrity was perfect, Helaman's was, but he had shown it in this case. He says, he not only says, we don't want your help, we want it very badly, but he says, do not break your oath. I forbid you. You must not break that oath. You've taken it, you see. And when these young men saw that, he says, this is a man who does what he says. We follow him, and they do, see. And they went to the city of Judea to assist Antipas. Notice old world names in New World here. Half the names in upstate New York are classical names, aren't they? Because they were settled by a lot of classical trained Dutch people. City of Judea to assist Antipas. He had appointed the leader. I had joined the 2,000 to the army of Antipas, so he didn't strengthen it. And his army had been greatly reduced by the Lamanites. Well, and the Lamanites had also retained many prisoners, among whom are the chief captains, for none other have they spared alive. Notice he says, the Lamanites, they don't take prisoners of war. They just spare the captains for exchange. That's what they're doing. See? That's very different from Moroni's practice. And then notice he sends a map with the letter here. These are the cities which the Lamanites have obtained. Of course, in a thing like that, you'd have to send a map, a situation map with him. And he lists the cities, Manti, Zizrom, Kumeni, Antipara, Judea, quite a list, you see. Antipas and his men toiling with their might to fortify that city. And they were, now this illustrates another point of Clausewitz, this next verse, 16th. And they were depressed in body as well as spirit, for they had fought valiantly by day and toiled by night. They had to work by night to make up the fortifications that had been cut down, and they had to fight all day. And thus they suffered great afflictions of every kind. Now notice Clausewitz says, spirit's not the same as morale. Their morale was low, but they were determined. Now they were determined. This little force gave me great hopes. They were determined to go on fighting. Their morale was high, you see. Their spirit was low. They were wiped out. They were exhausted, but they weren't going to give up. That's the difference between morale and spirit here. Spirit is the alone, first alone battle and that sort of thing, you see. And the Lamanites saw the orders of Amoron not to come out against Judea. Amoron told them to lie low and not do anything against Judea, but they were favored of the Lord, and that's, here again, is a case of chance. Amoron was foolish not to have commanded them to attack then, but he didn't. Chance plays a great part, and this saved our necks. He says they have perhaps destroyed our, they might have destroyed our little army if they'd attacked then. Then was the right time for him to do it, but he didn't do it. Hooray for us. And so war is, as Clausewitz says, a game of chance. And we were desirous the Lamanites would come upon us, for we were not desirous to make an attack upon them in the strongholds. Well, Clausewitz again, the defense position is always the strongest. We wanted them to attack us. We didn't want to attack them. Though you would think war until Clausewitz's time was always attack, martial attack, force, and so forth. So we spent reconnaissance to find out what the situation was. Therefore, they were desirous that they should pass by us to fall upon them in their rear. Now, one of these things, and they're in a quandary. They durst not pass by with their whole army. See, good old Amoron is boxed in now. He has the strongest army, but he has minor forces on every side he's going to move in. You can analyze it here. They were brought into us many provisions, and while they were waiting there, he didn't know what to do, so they were waiting. Meantime, they're receiving reinforcements. Provisions, they got 2,000 more sons here. Well, from the fathers of those, my 2,000 sons, they sent provisions. They wanted that more than anything else. And now 2,000 men were sent from Zarahemla to join. See, 2,000 more. And the Lamanites, to see their forces increasing, began to be very nervous. The 29th verse here, they began to be fearful. And so we've got to put a stop to this. And this gives Helaman the idea how they're going to break the deadlock here. They began to be fearful, and they began to sally forth trying to stop these supplies from coming in, to put an end to our receiving provisions, in the 29th verse, you see. And then Antipas ordered that I should march forward with my little sons. Calling little sons is interesting, isn't it? I know some of you are taking Russian here. Dicha, the Russian colonel, always calls, not only in the novels, but in the army today still, is Dicha, little children. That's what he always calls the men. They're Dicha, they're little children. We call them boys and things like that. But that's been traditional for hundreds of years. And it's the same thing here. He calls them his little sons. He uses a correlative, he does. In English, we have to use the word little with everything. But other languages has these correlatives, these diminutive forms they use that we don't use. We put line and shen on the end and things like that. We don't use that. But say other languages are rich in these. That's one of the things in which English is impoverished. These things, but you obviously have to use their little boy, little guy, little this, little that, and so forth. But they have a special word for the little one. Well, anyway, little kids, if we carry provisions to a neighboring city, they're going to act as if they were carrying provisions. This is just a provisional force. That's all it is. We're not military or anything like that. They start marching along the coast like that, so he knows that they'll come out and try to stop them. That's what they're going to do. And then he can play that old trick and have somebody follow them, you see. The city of Antipas was stationed the strongest army of the Lamanites, too strong to be taken, like the city of Munich here. And so they saw this band going along the coast with provisions. In the 36th verse, when they saw them, they too good to lose. You can't let them get away. So they chased us, and we ran away in front of them, always northward, and thus we'd lead away the most powerful army of the Lamanites. They thought it would have been a pushover, an easy thing, get this out of the way. Yet, to a considerable distance, insomuch that they saw the army of Antipas pursuing them, yes. But they didn't stop for the army of Antipas. They were the strongest. They kept right on after us. That would be the best thing to do. And then it was night. They didn't overtake us. What we did, we marched around behind them to where Antipas was. Before dawn, the Lamanites were pursuing us again. Rather, they go ahead then. They were not strong to contend with them, so they kept... I would not suffer them to fall into our hand. Our little sons, notice he calls them my little sons, should fall into their hands. Therefore, we did continue our march, and we took our march into the wilderness. It's a running away now. Nobody dared turn either direction. They were all going, the 2,000 big Lamanite army and Antipas' littler army that was chasing them, all in a beeline up the coast, and nobody dared turn to the right or the left. They just kept going. And we did flee all day into the wilderness till it was dark another day. And that kept on the third day of the seventh month. And then he said, how about it, kids, if you had enough running away, they would do anything rather than run away anymore, because they hadn't come out for that, you see. They had enough of that. And when he unleashed them, therefore, what say ye, my sons, will ye go against them to battle? He really unleashed them in the... In 56 and 56, there's something about that, you know. It's in this very chapter itself, in the 56th verse, I think. They fought with such miraculous strength. They did frighten the enemies here. And the seasoned Lamanite soldiers had never seen anything like this. Well, this is what happened in 1948 in Israel, see. Those kids, Jewish kids, they could never fight because they were always the underdogs, whoever they were, and so forth. And they'd been underdogs so long. They were completely surrounded by our army, huge Egyptian force, huge Syrian force, everything coming in from all directions. And they just wiped them out. I mean, it terrified them. These soldiers had never seen anything like that. They were absolutely dedicated. And that's what you have here. They fought with such miraculous strength. They did frighten them. They frightened the Lamanite soldiers. For this cause, they delivered themselves and say, I give up. We can't fight this. They said, you can't fight City Hall. We can't fight this. And this is why, therefore. And he tells them why they didn't. He talks about them. Never had I seen so great courage. God would not suffer that we should fall. We would not slay our brethren if they would let us alone, he says. There's no rancor here. Good old sporting Helaman. He's even more strict on this than Moroni is. Well, they'd never fought before. But they'd rehearsed unto me the words of their mothers. They told me what their situation was. And a terrible battle commenced. When they came up behind, the battle between Antipas and the Lamanites had already begun. The enemy was already engaged. And so they're attacked from the rear now. And the army of Antipas was exhausted, just about to give in. And Antipas had already fallen. And they began to fall and to give away. And the Lamanites were pursuing with great vigor. That was just the time for he was forced to strike from the side. Of course, it's exactly what you do. You hold your cavalry away on the side, you see, Alexander's and Caesar's pet wing. You have a block of elite troops on one side. You have the Hystaspes of the Alexander the Great and the golden shields. They would come in when the battle was going this way or that way. Just then was the time to hit with that, you see. It hit like a thunderbolt. And that made all the difference. See, it's just the timing. You always have to hold something in reserve. And at the Battle of the Bulge, we didn't have anything in reserve. We didn't even have a filing clerk in reserve. We had nothing. Being surprised like that. At the same time, the Russians had 85 divisions in reserve, mind you. They saved our necks time and again. That's all I was doing. Well, and after the battle, so they delivered them up to prisoners of war. This was Moroni's policy. He surrounded them insomuch they were compelled to deliver up their weapons of war and also themselves as prisoners of war. And not one of the 2,000 had fallen. They'd fought with such miraculous strength that frightened the enemy. There was no place for their prisoners. What could they do? So they sent them to the land of Zarahemla. Now, it came out that I received an epistle from Amoron. Amoron wants to make another prisoner exchange here. We're not getting anywhere. We're getting stalled now with prisoner exchanges here. If I would deliver up those prisoners of war, which they'd lost in that battle, we would only deliver them on a certain basis. Deliver up that our prisoners on exchange of, namely, Nephite family. Amoron refused. The people of Antipara did leave the city and fled to the other cities. Now, this is this fourth verse. This is the turning point of the war. From now, everything starts to slow down and go downward from the limits. There's a psychological point when you can tell which way it's going to go. And that sometimes will come quite early, sometimes quite late. The city of Antipara, the war can drag on for years, and yet you know how it's going to turn out. It's an interesting thing. The German high officers, those that we got and those that we tuned in on the radio and so forth, they knew when the turning point of the war had come already, almost just after the invasion of Normandy, they knew it was over. And yet the war went on. That was 44. It went off till May 45. Didn't need to, but that's the way things go. The city of Antipara fell into our hands. 29th year, we received a supply of provisions added to Droam. Then 6,000 men, six of the sons, besides 60 of the sons of the Ammonites, 60 more joined the 2,000. You see, 60 more of their brothers joined the 2,000. To my little band of 2,000. And they wanted to get the city of Comenia. And so they surrounded Comenia by night a little before they would receive supply of provisions, before they were to get the provisions, and camped around the city and slept upon ourselves. Now, what kind of a trick would they pull on them now? How could you bring them out? You see, the way you can't conquer this very strong and defended city, so he used another very good trick, he said. We camped so close to them, we almost insulted right under their nose. Well, they couldn't let that go on. In the first place, we'd cut off their supplies, and in the second place, we could be easily handled. Oh, we've been strung before, but look, we can't let them camp right in front of the gates here. So they had to come out, and that's all they wanted, you see. And they dragged them into the usual traps and so forth that went on, these traps that are... But we can't go on with warfare forever. We come to other grim matters presently.